in these kind of like fantasy stories, quite often the sort of the roguish characters, often the one that steals the show. I think it's the same in Game of Thrones as well, when you have Tyrion Lannister. And like Tyrion is like not necessarily maybe what you think about when you think about the quintessential kind of rogue type character, but he absolutely is that kind of character, because he's all about machinations behind the scenes and pulling strings. And I think one thing that, if we think about like what kind of makes a, what is kind of a rogue sort of character, what is the identifying factor, and I think this kind of ties into why I like them so much on a personal level, I think it's because they obviously come in many different shapes and sizes and whatnot, like there's many different kind of variants of the rogue, but I think what reunites them all is the fact that they all have to rely on their wits and their kind of ingenuity and their kind of intelligence to kind of change the situation to their advantage, and they will often do that without you even realizing they've done it. And I think that to me is just more interesting than kind of, as I said in like previous episode, like smashing someone's head in with a warhammer. There is totally a place for that, and it's, I kind of enjoy that as well, you know, but not as much as I enjoy someone kind of using their smarts to kind of outwit an opponent in a kind of an ingenious kind of way. That to me is just much more satisfying. Like for, as a reader, I find that like just way more interesting. And I think as from a writing point of view, I think it offers so many more kind of opportunities in terms of creating like an interesting character.
What is up, everybody? You're listening to episode 102 of SFF Addicts. I'm your host, Adrian M. Gibson, and welcome to your weekly dive into the world of science fiction, fantasy, and writing craft. Joining me, as always, is my co-host, the Chewie to my Han Solo, the Joker to my Commander Shepard, my dear MJ Kuhn. How are you, MJ?
Hi, I am wonderful. How are you?
Doing spiffy today.
Spiffy.
So spiffy. And if you want to go support MJ and her work, you can pick up The Blue Baby, Among Thieves. Very fitting for today's topic, no? And
right?
The Green Baby, Thick Ass Thieves. If you want some thieving goodness after you listen to this episode on Rogues and Thieves, then you are fucking set with the Tales of Tomorrow.
You are good to go.
Good to go. Go buy Silverbrook Promise too.
Yeah, right? Extra thieving. All the thieves. And if you want to catch the thieves and and learn about the police procedural part... Look at that transition, Adrian. I did
Damn,
great there.
Doing good.
Grab you some Mushroom Blues by our lovely Adrian M. Gibson.
Yeah. Okay. I love that. Catch the thieves or be the thief, whatever you
or want. Be the thief or both. You know, life's about balance, folks.
It's all about balance. All right. Quick note for everyone out there listening or watching, the official SFF Addicts Patreon and merch store are live. So check the links in the description to support what we do here. Also, don't forget to rate and review the podcast on your favorite podcast app. And subscribe to the FanFi Addict YouTube channel, where this and every other episode of the show is available in full video. And now, joining us once again is James Logan, wonderfully talented author of The Silver Blood Promise. Welcome back, James. How are you?
Thank you. I'm good. It's been a long time. Long time no see. Yeah.
Right. It's been hours, it's been, days, or months.
Things have changed. Our entire lives have gone on different courses since we last
all came
spoke.
Back wearing the same clothes.
I remembered what I wore and thought, you know, gotta, yeah.
Just for old times.
Just old times sake. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
A heads up, this is part two of our two-part chat with James, so I recommend checking out part one to get to know him better. Today, though, keep one hand on your coin purse, because today we're talking about thieves and rogues in fantasy and science fiction. And I will toss this out just to kick things off. What is it about rogues and thieves that you find to be so fascinating? And what draws you to them as both a reader and a writer?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because like thinking about this conversation that we were going to have kind of made me think about sort of that exact question and what it was. And because when I realized, when I thought about it, I didn't actually know straight away. Like, and I thought that the more I thought about it, the more I kind of uncovered about sort of what I think makes these kind of characters really interesting, but also what makes them kind of, well, they're sort of interesting and fun to read, but also interesting and fun to write. I think on, I don't know, it's like, I think if you look at a lot of them, like, if you look at Star Wars, like, Han Solo is like the best character, right? I mean, come on, you know, Han and Chewie, just it's awesome. So much cooler than Luke Skywalker.
That's like, why MJ and I dropped that in our intro.
We identify.
But I just feel like, you know, Han is the most, I just feel like Han Solo and Chewie are the most interesting kind of characters and the most interesting dynamic in that. And then, like, I don't know, in Baldur's Gate 3, I think Astarion is, like, by far the most interesting character. It's just fun, cool, funny, just interesting.
Dark, but wonderful.
And, like, just, you kind of feel like at the same time there's goodness deep inside that sometimes comes out, but you've only very briefly get a glimpse of it, and then he goes back
unless
to being,
you make him the super vampire,
exactly,
he breaks up with you. If you didn't know that, players, don't make him the super vampire, he dumps you. It's so rude.
Wow,
I got dumped by a video game character.
I didn't make him the super vampire on my first playthrough, but I might on my next one just to kind of make that happen. But
what a shitty guy. Oh, you become a super vampire and then
so much better than me anyway.
But it's like, I think it's quite a common thing that, like, sort of in these kind of like fantasy stories, quite often the sort of the roguish characters, often the one that steals the show. I think it's the same in Game of Thrones as well, when you have Tyrion Lannister, and like Tyrion is like not necessarily maybe what you think about when you think about the quintessential kind of rogue type character, but he absolutely is that kind of character, because he's all about machinations behind the scenes and pulling strings. And I think one thing that, if we think about like what kind of makes what is kind of a rogue sort of character, what is the identifying factor? And I think this kind of ties into why I like them so much on a personal level. I think it's because they obviously come in many different shapes and sizes and whatnot. Like there's many different kind of variants of the rogue. But I think what reunites them all is the fact that they all have to rely on their wits and their kind of ingenuity and their kind of intelligence to kind of change the situation to their advantage, and they will often do that without you even realizing they've done it. And I think that to me is just more interesting than kind of, as I said in like previous episode, like smashing someone's head in with a warhammer. There is totally a place for that, and it's, I kind of enjoy that as well, you know, but not as much as I enjoy someone kind of using their smarts to kind of outwit an opponent in a kind of an ingenious kind of way. That to me is just much more satisfying. Like as a reader, I find that like just way more interesting. And I think from a writing point of view, I think it offers so many more kind of opportunities in terms of creating like an interesting character and also an interesting kind of plot as well. So I guess that's why I like rogues, is because of that, but also because they have the best clothes. I mean, black leathers, like,
and the best tools, cool, too.
Best tools, best clothes. Yeah. Like, I mean, you know, but also I think like there's just something quite intriguing. There you see, look, there you go, like on the cover of MJ's book.
I mean, yeah, well, look at those clothes.
Exactly.
Damn. Like, do you want chainmail and like leather?
Or do you want? Yeah, exactly. Do you want that, or do you want kind of like just boring plate armor and like mage robes or something? No, you don't. You want the cool, supple leather armor that is like, you know, doesn't make a noise when you move. That's cool, right? That's
and that Sith hood.
Yeah, exactly. Like, but it's funny, right? Because this is funny because we like, I think going back a little bit, sort of to like the 2010s, which kind of feels like last week to me, but apparently was like a decade and a half ago, go figure. Like in fantasy and kind of like epic fantasy, those kind of like hooded figure covers were like completely ubiquitous. Like they were just everywhere. And to the point where it kind of became like a running joke, and you know, we would like, some people would laugh about it and stuff. But the point is they sold books because people bought them because there was something about that hooded person kind of dynamic that just said adventure, mystery, intrigue, like danger. I think it says so much, just with that simple kind of like depiction of a person in a cloak and a hood. But it's, yeah, it's like really simple, but it says so much. And I think that kind of the intrigue it kind of projects is just something that I think speaks to so many people. And I think that's why those kind of books, this is looking at it more from a publishing point of view, but I think that kind of intrigue and that sense of danger and betrayal and all those kind of things, clearly spoke to a large audience. And I think that kind of says quite a lot about the kind of character that you know those covers represent, the kind of the thief, the rogue. I just feel like maybe on some basic level, they just have a certain intrigue about them that you just don't really get with a lot of other characters. And maybe that's why we're kind of drawn to them. Maybe that's why readers are drawn to them. And that's why maybe writers are kind of drawn to them as well. I don't know. They're just kind of, they're kind of alluring, aren't they? They just have that kind of allure that you, it's funny because I'm saying all this, but like when I play RPGs, I'm always a mage. So what the hell do I know? I just, you know.
When you read, you're always looking for that.
Multiples. you can. And like that's, you know, and the kind of like the thief mage kind of thing, of which there are very many examples. And this is what I just said just now. Like there's all kind of variants and stuff. And I feel like with rogues in particular, there's so many different kind of variants you can kind of dip into. Like, but anyway, I think that's, you know, to answer the in a very roundabout way, that I think that's why I feel like rogues are just super interesting kind of characters.
Well, when you're talking about the betrayal and all these kind of like darker elements, I feel like we can't really talk about rogues, thieves, gritty settings, you know, these kind of things we're talking about today without bringing up the concept of moral grayness, you know, a morally gray character. So I want to know how, and people are kind of all over the map, right? Oh, this character's super morally gray. And then people will be like, no, they're not because of X, Y, Z. How do you kind of define and approach morally gray when it comes to characters? And what's your advice for balancing the need for a character to be likable, for someone, you know, the reader to want to live inside their head to an extent, with making them a little bit gritty? What's your advice there?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting, isn't it? Obviously, you don't want to kind of veer off sort of too much into the kind of, you don't want to make them too unlikable, I guess, is what I'm saying. Because I struggle actually with, boy, I'm going to go off on a tangent again. I did warn you guys that I do this. But so well, one of the things that's been kind of like really super interesting to me as a kind of a new author is seeing readers reacting to my work, and not necessarily just in the kind of like, I thought it was great, or I thought it sucked. Like, you know, that's interesting in its own way. But it's also seeing other people viewing your work through their own kind of lens, and just seeing how they categorize it and what they regard it as. And that to me is super interesting because, you know, some people have kind of, there is sort of like a sort of a little argument that's going on amongst people that have read Silverblood, and it's kind of split between people that think it is grimdark and people who think it's not. And I just find that super interesting because I don't think it is at all like grimdark. And I think the reason it isn't for me is because it has, I think, or I like to think it has real heart in it. And I think that the characters, you know, while they might not, their kind of general viewpoints might not always be in perfect alignment with society, and they might potentially have some malleable kind of morals, I think ultimately they're trying to do the right thing. It's not just about themselves, it's about the greater good. And I think that's kind of like Lucan's sort of story. It kind of starts out with him doing, like, he's investigating his father's murder. He's trying to find out who's killed his father and why. And that's the kind of the driving mystery. But his kind of journey goes from being about that to then, obviously, he gets, I don't want to say too much because of spoilers and stuff, but he does kind of get tangled up in this much bigger conspiracy that threatens the whole city. And his kind of viewpoint changes from being kind of self-centered and pursuing his own goal to suddenly pursuing something which is tangentially related, but really it's also about a much bigger picture. And that bigger picture is kind of the one that he ends up sort of thinking about more, almost, and kind of like finding out his father's murderer is kind of almost taking a back seat to that. And that was really hard during the writing process, actually, to do that, because I remember some of the early feedback I got was kind of like saying, this is confusing because he's doing this for half the book and then suddenly he changes trajectory and he's trying to do something else. So it did kind of become quite hard to sort of balance the needs of the plot against the kind of realism of someone kind of like changing the sort of direction that they're kind of running in. But I think it was necessary, because not just for the plot, but also because I think readers will ultimately connect more with a character that is kind of pursuing something that is greater than themselves. You know, they're not just pursuing a personal goal that is only really relevant to them. They're pursuing something which is to the betterment of like a whole group of people. And I think Lucan kind of fits into the, like, as a kind of a rogue type character. I mean, he's not maybe like not a, again, he's kind of like a bit like Tyrion Lannister, I guess, in the sense that he's not necessarily a conventional kind of rogue character. He's not like a pickpocket. He's not like an assassin. He's not like kind of like a cat burglar type who's going to be climbing walls and stuff. But he is kind of very smart, and he is, you know, got a certain way of like manipulating events to, and, you know, he can do the whole con man thing as well to some extent. And I think, so he's not like necessarily a conventional rogue, but I think where he does become more conventional is that he kind of fits that rogue with a heart of gold kind of thing, which is like, it's a classic kind of like, you know, archetype type thing. And I wouldn't necessarily say he's got a heart of gold, but I do think he has got a better moral compass than a lot of kind of cutthroat types would normally have. So he's kind of like a really flawed person who generally is trying to do the right thing. And I think that's the key, I think, to writing a character that is kind of like has roguish tendencies, but is also kind of likable. I think it's to make it clear that, like, despite being really broken in many ways and sometimes potentially being a bit of a dick, he's a good guy. Like, you know, to believe it all, he's one of the good guys. So I think that's how you balance it. Whereas I have struggled a little bit with novels where, like, I'm a big fan of David Gemmell, and he once said that he was kind of like talking about the context of kind of like morally ambiguous characters, and he kind of said, look, Gray kind of characters, morally ambiguous characters are great, but if you have too many of them, all you have is a gray novel. And I've read books where, you know, good, like kind of technically very good books that I can appreciate on many levels, but they're so gray, like, that there's just, like, I end up kind of thinking, I'm not really sure who I'm meant to be rooting for. Am I meant to be rooting for anyone? Or maybe I'm not. Like, maybe that's the point. Maybe all of these people are just terrible and I'm not really meant to root for anyone. But the trouble is, I'm the kind of reader that needs to hang off someone. I need at least one character that I feel is kind of doing the right thing and I can get behind. And if I don't have that, then I really kind of just struggle with the novel because I have nothing to hold on to. And ultimately, why should I care about a novel if it's just horrible people doing horrible things to each other? In the end, it kind of doesn't matter to me who wins because they're all dreadful people. Like, whereas I kind of, I don't know, maybe this makes me a bit traditional, a bit old fashioned or whatever, but like, I kind of like a novel where, like, yeah, you can have morally ambiguous characters for sure. And like, Lucan is definitely can be morally ambiguous at times, but it's clear what side he's on. There is a clear good side and there's a clear bad side. And, you know, I think, you know, that's important to me as kind of like both a reader and an author. And I think that helps readers kind of identify with a character. Like, in fact, you know, I think that's a really effective way of making them identify with the character because they can clearly see that they are the good guy or on the side of good. But at the same time, they are such a flawed character that they feel realistic. So I guess what we're really talking about here is kind of how do you kind of create a character which is kind of readers can sympathize with and empathize with, but also feels interesting. And I think one of the problems with the books that I read growing up, I mean, they weren't problems at the time, but I think if I return to them now, I would probably struggle with them a little bit because a lot of the heroes in those kind of big epic fantasies, they're just, you know, like the farm boys that have kind of got some hidden destiny vanilla or whatever. They are kind of vanilla, right? And in a way that made sense because they are the springboard for the whole series. So, you know, they're
the avatar for the reader as well.
Yeah, of course they are. And like they serve a very clear purpose. But I think that made sense at the time because those books are all concerned with like really big stakes, big worlds, all of these kind of things. But the trouble is, I think that the tastes have just changed a bit and actually people now, characters like that, I don't think would work so well. I think modern readers are kind of looking for more characters that just feel more authentic. And I don't think, like, you know, kind of a square-jawed kind of hero that always tries to do the right thing regardless. I don't think people can connect with that because how many people do we really, I mean, goodness knows the world needs more people like that for sure. But like, you know, like how many really, even the best people, even the people I consider the best people in my life that I really would look up to, I wouldn't necessarily put any of them in that kind of selfless kind of category, you know? I think readers might struggle to really connect with and understand characters like that. Whereas if you have someone that has a bit of a drinking problem and has difficult relationships with his father and, you know, likes gambling maybe a little bit too much and tends to get into a bit of trouble, but nonetheless is kind of actually, those problems aside, is a decent person. They're just having a bit of a hard time of it. I know, straight away you can think of at least a handful of people I know that kind of fit that category. I just think it's a much more relatable kind of experience for people. And so I suppose that's why I think rogues can be such a good character for a modern fantasy novel because they fit into that category of being broken and flawed and therefore believable, but you can still put them in the hero role where they can still be a rogue still kind of live on the wrong side of the law, but if they're fighting against a tyrannical government or something, then actually they're the good guy, even though you wouldn't necessarily put them in that category, but they are to all intents and purposes. And that's where I think it kind of gets interesting, because like you can play around with like the morals of, you can dive into the kind of the morals of the character. One of my favorites kind of anti-hero rogue type characters is Waylander from the novel of the same name by David Gemmell. I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with it, but his one of the best opening scenes for a kind of a rogue character is literally the first scene of the book. Actually, no, this is a prologue, but chapter one, the first scene, Waylander walks into a clearing and basically these bandits have stolen his horse and they're now in the process of torturing a priest because that's what they do. They're bandits and they're horrible people. Waylander, on the other hand, is kind of our grizzled kind of like anti-hero, and he's a bit of a bastard, but also kind of, you know, he's good beneath all of that. But he walks in and he basically just says, give me my horse back. And so they're kind of like, lol, it's one against five, old man, like, good luck, you know. And so like instantly like whips the cloak back, and like, because he has the double crossbow that shoots two bolts, which I unashamedly stole for Flea, and that's where that comes from. So just gonna, you know, just gonna put that out there. That's an homage to David Gamble. Exactly, it is, totally. But he whips out the double crossbow and takes two of them down, and then kind of unclasps the cloak and then gets the daggers out and just like throws both of them. And suddenly there's just the ringleader left. And the guy's kind of like, oh, okay, you can have your horse. And he's like, no, it's too late now, buddy. And then no, he kills. Exactly. It takes him out as well. So that is like just incredibly badass and cool. But what's really cool then is that he gets the horse, then he goes to leave, and the priest who they were torturing is still tied to the tree. And he's like, excuse me, dude, can you like cut me down? And Raylan's just like, why would I do that? You know, that's such a cool moment, because that would never happen in one of those fantasy books that I read when I was growing up. The hero would never say something like that. But the fact that the Waylander is just like, why would I bother? Like, who are you to me? Why should I expend the effort, kind of thing? And in the end, he does cut him down, because like I said, he's the good kind of rogue, you know. But it's just such an interesting dynamic to have a main character that kind of thinks like that, that like, you know, will probably do the right thing ultimately, but it's not necessarily his first kind of inclination. Also with Waylander, the interesting thing was he was the assassin that killed the king, and now he's the only one that can save the land. That's such a cool dynamic for a main character who, he is the bad guy. He is actually, in the eyes of the people of this country, he is the villain. But he's now the hero of the story, and his whole arc is a redemptive arc towards kind of redeeming himself and realizing that maybe he shouldn't have done that act that he did, and to some extent seeking to kind of make amends for it. But like immediately, that is a way more interesting arc to me than like, I don't know, some farm boy discovering that some ancient dude in their family line was some king or something, like, you know, like that, you know.
Or on the other end of the spectrum, like you were saying, like pure grimdark, where it's like, who am I supposed to root for? And I love that you're kind of touching on this, like, you can have your rogues and thieves and these kinds of characters exist within a spectrum of morality.
Yeah.
But you can layer that, where it's like different characters have different sort of moral compasses, and you can have people that lean more towards being identifiably good versus identifiably good bad versus within the context evil, of this. Yeah. And then within all of that, you can have a world that, and a setting that presents opportunities for these characters to act and show the readers where they stand, and that can fluctuate all the time. So it's like you can have them make bad decisions and you can have them make good decisions. And so I wanted to ask you about like how we fit characters like rogues and thieves into the settings that they live in and steal and cheat in and all this kind of stuff, and how you went about approaching the world, approaching the city of Safrona. And you kind of touched on it a little bit, but why you went for like a low fantasy setting, a grittier setting, as opposed to the more traditional sword and sorcery, kings and knights and all that shit.
Yeah, yeah.
That is becoming a bit tiresome, at least for me, but...
Yeah, I mean, just to kind of row back slightly, just to go back to the point you just made about the kind of different sort of boundaries and morality and stuff, I think a really great example of that is Breaking Bad and the character of Walter White, who across the series, what I love about that series, I really need to rewatch it actually, because it's been quite a long time, but one of the things I really love about the series, one of the reasons I think it's such great kind of character work, is it Walter White is the main character. He's the kind of main protagonist in it. But the series constantly asks you the question, do you still sympathize with him? And then he'll do something else. And then the series is like, do you still sympathize with him? And then he'll do something else. And it's increasingly terrible each time. But nonetheless, you still find yourself thinking, I still kind of want him to win, though. Like, I still kind of feel like I can support him. And it gets to the point where he's doing some really terrible shit. And you're kind of like, yeah. And then you're like, no, wait, this is wrong. This is so wrong. But it's really smart the way it kind of like gets you to buy into that. And it plays with that morality so, so well. And just by keeping pushing it and then making you keep decide whether or not you feel like it's okay what he's doing. And I just think that's incredibly smart and great storytelling. And I just thought of that when, you know, the point you just made about like different ranges of morality and where they sit. But I mean, in terms of kind of creating the sort of fantasy world, I mean, this kind of that these kind of people inhabit, I think this kind of goes back to what we were just talking about the pirates and their articles on the ships. You know, they essentially created this world for themselves because they had kind of, they'd fled. Most of them came from like merchant vessels and the Royal Navy, and like where like discipline was enforced absolutely brutally. I've been to like the National Archives at Kew Gardens and like seen the original like 18th century kind of reports and stuff. Really, really wild. Like it takes like an hour to read a short paragraph because it's like copperplate gothic kind of writing, and you're just like, I have no idea what this says, and like it just takes forever to read. But like, it's insane because you're reading it and like you're just getting this like glimpse into the, like 300 years ago, and like reading about these really horrendous things that like the punishment that was enforced and the way these men were treated. I mean, it's no surprise really that they thought, you know what, like this sucks, we might as well go do something that is kind of similar, but at least, you know, and it might get us killed, but we're probably going to die anyway if we stay in this, let's go and do our own thing. And so, but like one of the first things they did when they broke away and created a pirate crew was to form that their list of articles, which as we said was a very democratic way of like divvying up plunder and who was in charge, the chain of command, when it was acceptable to do things, you know, all of these like really, and kind of, I can't really like think of it off the top of my head, like some of them are really quite specific and like really, so it was a really structured life. And we think of pirates as kind of being like, you know, swilling rum and just generally being riotous and kind of like absolute mayhem, and it kind of was at times, particularly if you're on Blackbeard's crew, because boy, that would have been interesting because he was definitely crazy. But you know, the fact that they actually, you know, that image we have isn't really realistic. Like they had these very structured, like kind of societies that they built for themselves. Even down to like having like, you know, like Tortuga or whatever, the pirate kind of hideout. So all the crews would go and basically just like hang out together or do their thing. But like, it was kind of neutral ground. And so even there, it was kind of, there were rules, you know, and that's what I find like so interesting is these people were criminals. And in some cases they were really bloodthirsty, hardened criminals. And yet they had this code that they lived by. And so I think that's super interesting, but it's also when it comes to world building and creating like a criminal underworld, I think you need to think of it in that way. I think you it's not just enough to go, oh, they're criminals, so they just kind of do criminal stuff. It's like, no, actually, like they're human beings, and human beings always have structure. Like they always have like these kind of, it's ironic because they're kind of like, they're criminals because they don't like the law, but they create their own kind of laws anyway. And I think, yeah, if you read Scott Lynch, for example, like Liza Lottlamora, I think the underworld in that book is just like it's incredibly like, there's a clear defined structure that he's clearly thought about a lot. And he's like, well, who is in charge and how do the chains of command work and who reports to who and who takes what share of the, I kind of like tried to dip into that a little bit in Silver Blood, but there wasn't really like, the story didn't really allow me to do it too much. One of the things with Silver Blood, actually, without wanting to go off on a huge tangent, was Ashra originally had her own POV storyline in the book, and we got to see a huge amount of the underworld stuff going on, and we saw a lot more of it than we do in the finished book. I had to take it out because it made the book way too long, yeah, that was a shame, and also just a real headache because I had to kind of rewrite the last part of the book, because obviously she still appears in it, but now like the reader doesn't have the benefit of seeing her backstory, so they have no idea who she is. So I had to kind of like find out a way of like, how do I introduce her, and so when she turns up they know who she is. And it took me a few attempts to get that right. It was really difficult, but yeah, so originally you saw a lot more of the underworld, and I did have a lot more about how kind of this, how it was structured, and like you've obviously got the Twice Crowned King, who is the kind of the ruler of the underworld, but it had a lot more about how they control it, and this, the power structures and the little rivalries that you have. So I think this is all, you know, this is all stuff I think that it makes sense to think about when you're building a world, particularly one that's focused on these kind of people pursuing these kind of endeavors. You know, ironically, yeah, it's like they're thieves and criminals who are, like, you know, breaking the law a lot of the time, but they have their own laws that they have to abide by, because if they don't, they're going to get in trouble. But so I think you need to think about that. I think you need to think about the structure and how the kind of the power and how it is distributed and all that kind of thing. I think that's probably a kind of sort of to create an authentic sort of setting for these kind of characters. I would say that's probably where you would want to start with that. And then you can kind of build out from there, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I'm always fascinated with is this kind of intersection between world and character and how they come together, how they feed into each other, how they play off of each other. And we talked a little bit in part one about, you know, your process in creating the story and how the characters and the dynamic specifically between Lucan and Flea was kind of one of the things that first came to be. I'm curious where the world building came into that, how, you know, the world impacts the characters and how they grow and change. And, you know, if you have any advice for authors looking to create a world that is well suited to their scoundrels and maybe their arcs.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I think this sort of like links back to what we were just talking about making these characters sort of like you know, relatable. And I think that Ashra and Flea are both products of their environment. They were both kind of born into this. Like, I mean, Flea was literally born into kind of being a, she was born into this life, and Ashra was like shunted into it by, you know, by sort of various tragedy that sort of changed her personal situation. So both of them have grown up in this environment. And what I kind of find interesting about that is it kind of makes them underdogs, right? Like, and people love an underdog. And in a way it makes them, one of the things I was going to say was like, even though these characters are kind of rogue types, in a way, they are more honest than many other kind of characters, because they're not ashamed about what they do, and they're not trying to hide what they do. Whereas, you know, to take like the Pontifex, for example, who is like the head of the you know, the kind of church in Sophrona, he is kind of presents himself as one thing, but he's very much something else, and also kind of thinks nothing of, like, you know, taking a few coins from the collection plate and slipping them into those drooping sleeves of his, you know. So in a way it's kind of funny because you have this dynamic where these thieves are actually more honest about what they do than the kind of head of the church is. And then the same goes for many of the other figures in authority. And I think, you know, so, but that's because they're the product of their environment. And, you know, the fact that they've been forced into these kind of roles, they've not really gone into them willingly. They do it because they have to survive. And I think that survival element is like a strong kind of driver for both of them. So it's kind of a case of like, yeah, the world kind of, I suppose, making them like that. But I think that really engenders kind of the sympathy kind of vote from readers in a way. But that's kind of a way that I suppose that the world has kind of impacted on like those particular characters. But I think the same is also true of kind of a lot of the, I suppose, you know, Sophrona is like, it's kind of a trade city. That's what its main characteristic is about, the idea that you can buy anything, you can sell anything, anything can be bought, whether it's like some fish or it's like someone's death. There's anything can be bought there. And I guess that in a way, like buying and selling, it becomes part of the sort of everyday currency of everyday life, I suppose. And to some extent that's going to like affect everyone. And when you're growing up amidst all these trappings of like extreme wealth and extreme poverty, it's kind of like, you know, it just everything feeds into this kind of, you know, this, I suppose, material is creating this materialistic kind of, I suppose, to some extent, a really materialistic kind of environment, to some extent, where I suppose the rich people want more of it and the people who have nothing kind of are trying to just get something. And, you know, so everyone's kind of, I suppose, to some extent, everyone's hustling in a way, you know, which weirdly feels like modern life in many ways, because I feel like in the real world, like, people, you know, certainly, you know, people are being forced into having multiple jobs to kind of pay the rent and stuff because the spiraling cost of everything and just generally things, you know, not being amazing. And I suppose Sophronia is kind of like that as well. And, you know, everyone's kind of like hustling to try and get by. And I suppose it's, you know, that kind of makes it, it's focus on that. It's focus on accumulating wealth and just wealth being everywhere or, you know, or not being there as the case may be, but such a focus on it. And I suppose that kind of makes it a really, it makes it part of everyday life and it makes it a good, an obvious kind of environment to kind of tell this kind of story of kind of people who are struggling to survive and people who just want more power because the power they've got already is not enough. I suppose ultimately, like, it's about, I suppose one of the main kind of themes, I suppose, of the book is power and the distribution of power and the abuse of power. And that wasn't never intentional. I don't think about themes when I'm writing. I don't kind of think I'm going to write a book about, you know, such and such a thing. That's just not really how I approach it. I just want to write a book that is fun and will make people kind of just burn through the pages. But it's inevitable that, like, we, none of us live in a bubble and we're all influenced by things, you know, particularly the times that we're living in. And it's inevitable that these things will creep in and kind of, you know, when I started writing Silver Blood in like 2015 and I finished around sort of like 22 21 22, and like that, when you think about where the world was before that and where it was afterwards, so much happened in that kind of 6 years. Like, you had Brexit, you had Trump, you had Ukraine being invaded, you had, like, you know, COVID, you had like the environmental kind of the global environmental crisis. Like, the world felt like a really different place. And it's, you know, and a lot of that, I think a lot of those really terrible headlines and a lot of the things that we lived through they all come back to power and who has it and who doesn't, and what they choose, and what those who do have it, how they choose to use it, if they choose to use it at all. You know, so much of it comes back to that. And I think that's kind of, that inevitably kind of made its way into the book. And it's why I think, you know, this book is not about a Dark Lord who just wants to rule the world because that's what Dark Lords do. This is very much about men wanting power because the amount of power they've got isn't enough for them. And they're terrified of, like, the thought of other people having that power, and they're clinging onto it. And kind of like, this is actually going back to what we talked about before we even started recording, just, you know, about misconceptions of, like, the identities of countries that existed in some kind of imaginary illustrious past. But that's very much what the motivation for these people in this story is. The antagonists are very much like wedded to this idea of some glorious past of Sophronia, you know, and they want to kind of try and return to it. And their entire conspiracy is built around that desire. And I, you know, I think fantasy is at its kind of like most powerful when it really reflects the real world back at us. And I kind of feel like that's inadvertently what I was, I suppose, what I was doing with this book, not necessarily intentionally, but it, you know, it was reflecting these ideas of kind of like abuse of power and how it was being used and how that affects people kind of, you know, who are right down the bottom of society. And, you know, so I suppose between creating this kind of environment where, like, that's built on material wealth, and then also this plot line of, like, power and its abuses, that's kind of the perfect environment for having a kind of a rogue type character. Because, you know, inevitably rogues are kind of like drawn towards kind of stealing stuff and the kind of the wealth side of it. But also you often find them kind of fighting back against tyrannical governments and stuff. If you think about like Mistborn by Brandon Sanderson, for example, like that's very much kind of a band of rogues kind of, you know, and they're very much kind of rogue types. They're stealing stuff and they're doing all manner of kind of roguey things, but it's all kind of aimed about kind of overthrowing the kind of the Dark Lord who's taken over the city and stuff. And so they're kind of fighting for the greater good. And so I suppose, I guess, and you know, I didn't really realize I was doing this, as I said, and as I said to you, Adrian, like when we were talking earlier, it's like I sometimes you know, I look at how the book turned out. I don't really know how it got there. It just kind of did over the course of like writing and rewriting. It just kind of got there. So it's kind of hard to say one thing or the other about it. But I'm looking at it now, and it's quite interesting because this conversation has made me look at the book in a slightly different way. Looking at it now, I can see that, you know, whether it was deliberate or not, the book has got those kind of societal power structures in place. It has got the material wealth element in place. And that's helped tell the story. And it needs to be there for the story to work. So I get, you know, this is like a really very long-winded answer to your question. But like, I guess that's how you create a world to kind of, for the story to take place in. It's like, what does the character need? But also, like, what does the story arc need? Like, you know, what does the plot kind of need? And then it's, I guess it's a case of making sure you've covered those bases, I suppose, is what I'm saying.
You got me thinking about something really particular that I hadn't thought about when it comes to rogues and thieves and these kinds of roguelike characters, is just like the notion of negotiation and how so much of what they're doing is a negotiation of some aspect of their lived experience and the world that they inhabit.
Yeah.
Whether it's like the villains in the Silver Blood Promise and their sort of negotiation with their idealized version of the city and how they're going to go about sustaining what they have, their power, accruing more power, all that kind of stuff. But rogues and thieves are constantly in negotiation, whether it's like using their cunning to get out of a tricky situation, or it's talking to someone who inhabits like a different strata of society, or whether they're, you know, like you brought up Mistborn, but it also happens in the Silver Blood Promise where there's like a character from a lower status circumstance who's kind of like sneaking into a party with posh upper class people and that kind of thing, and the negotiation that they have to play in terms of portraying something that they aren't in order to sneak through a situation and uncover information and that kind of stuff. And so I love this idea of negotiation and how it's constantly present through the characters and their arcs, but also the setting. And you know, I think like grittier settings kind of allow for a more interesting breadth of negotiations as opposed to, you know, traditional sword and sorcery with castles and lords and that kind of stuff. There's not so much negotiation there because the lord has ultimate power.
Yeah.
And so how is someone from a lower status going to be able to, you know, overcome that sort of social?
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. And that's a really interesting point. And I think the negotiation thing is a really interesting point. And it's kind of, I think when you're in a rogue and you're kind of a rogue performing those kind of roles, you are constantly asking people a question. And the question is, do you believe me? Do you believe what I'm doing? So like, obviously there's, well, I don't want to say anything for spoilers, but there's obviously like, there's a scene, a sequence where Lucan impersonates kind of someone of a completely different occupation and uses that to infiltrate a particular place. And the whole time it is a negotiation in a way. It's him kind of saying to everyone he meets in that environment, do you believe I am who I say I am? And they're in turn kind of having to have that own conversation with themselves about like, this guy feels a bit off. Is he like for real or am I just imagining this? I'm not going to say anything because I'm worried about what might happen. Like, you know, this is like a dangerous situation for you. So I don't want to say anything, but this is something about this feels off. So it is a kind of a negotiation between both the rogue who's playing the role and the people who are like being sucked in by it. And they're both, you know, and Lucan as well, the whole time is he's kind of like, are they buying it? Like, is this convincing? Like, have I overstepped? Have I not done enough? And this comes back to like what we were talking about earlier about it. It's really fun to write these characters as an author because it just gives you so many different options in terms of how you can play something and also so many different situations that characters could find themselves in. So like Lucan impersonating someone or any rogue character impersonating another person, it's kind of like there's a performance element to it. And so it's like, are they doing enough? Are they not doing too much? If one other character says something to them, how should they react? They know how they would normally react, but they're not themselves. They're playing someone else, so they have to like there's all this double thinking going on, and like that can lead to some really interesting places. And actually, like, again, not spoiling anything, but Lucan ends up finding himself in a really quite desperate situation simply because someone asks him a question and he doesn't know what the appropriate answer would be, and he could just say no, I'm not doing it, and that would be fine, but he doesn't know that, so he kind of hedges his bets and goes, oh, okay, I'll do it. And then it turns out he didn't need to. And suddenly as a result of that, he finds himself in a really bad position. But that's just such a fun place to be as the writer, because you can have so much fun with that. And you know, how that plays into the character's kind of mindset and their own frustrations about not playing the role quite right. And I don't know, I just think that's really interesting. And there are all of these questions being asked, and are they being answered effectively? But like to kind of move on to your point about, yeah, I think like, again, with the classic epic fantasies, like you have these kind of like medieval Europe kind of like sort of landscapes, and you know, it's fine. It does the job, and you can do interesting things with them. I mean, George R. R. Martin certainly did well writing that kind of setting because he was prepared to do different things with it. But the problem with it is because you're on that scale, there's such distance between everything. And like, you know, when you're working to that scale, it becomes really problematic, as we saw in the final kind of stages of Game of Thrones, when they had all this cool action stuff happening. But the trouble was the setup was not geared up for that kind of story. because it went from being a kind of slow burn political kind of thing to then suddenly being much more of an action adventure kind of focus, which was fine.
How did they get from here to there so fast?
I don't mind that, because like I love action adventure as much as I love kind of like political intrigue and stuff. So the fact that it kind of segued into this kind of action adventure thing, I didn't mind that too much. The trouble was they had this massive setting that was not built for that. And this goes back to what I was just saying about building the city to kind of accommodate the characters in the story. The massive scope of that Game of Thrones, of Westeros, of that world, it's far too big for such a small kind of action-packed story. And that's why you had all these characters just teleporting around, and it got kind of ridiculous, right? And it's why you had kind of, you know, Arya's like, one minute she's in Braavos and suddenly she's at the Twins, like just stabbing Walder Frey or whatever. And it's just kind of like, that's cool, but like it doesn't make sense, because that journey takes weeks and she was there 5 minutes ago. So that kind of that I think is like one of the limitations of having a big kind of scope like that. I mean, it obviously offers a lot of benefits. If you want to write a big war kind of thing, epic, that's where you go. But I like the fast action-packed, you know, action adventure stuff, and that requires the smaller canvas, I think. Particularly in this kind of like fantasy genre. And obviously for like Indiana Jones, you've got planes and stuff, so you can fly around the world. We got the cool map transition. Yeah, right, exactly. So it's fine. But like when we're working within the confines of like a novel, and it kind of like with a roughly Renaissance kind of era level of technology, you just don't have those options. So you have to make sure the setting is built to accommodate it. And I think that's why the kind of the city kind of based adventure just works so well, because you have all of these, like you have the whole breadth of humanity like in one place. You have the really super rich people, and you have the really poor people, and you have everyone in between who's just kind of like this like mad rat scrum trying to kind of like just get a little bit higher on the chain. But all of this is kind of thrown together, and like and you can, you know, it just makes for really interesting environments. And I think London, in a way, to like use a real world example, is quite interesting, because like particularly like South London, where I kind of have lived for like the better part of a decade, it's just crazy, because like you have like super rich people, like super rich neighborhoods right next to like areas of massive poverty, and they are literally like a stone's throw apart. And like it's the only part of the city that really I think is like that. Like the other areas are more kind of one thing or the other, but like South London is just this mishmash of kind of like super exclusivity and then just super poor. You know, and like Grenfell, where obviously the fire was, I don't know if you heard about that in the States, but where the awful like tower block was set on fire, and like it was horrendous. But like that's in a really rich kind of part of London. Like, and so you have this like massive discrepancy. But I think that's what lends really kind of interesting, you know, dynamics to the story. Particularly with Grenfell, you had like politicians, you know, because they're like conservatives, they tend to be quite well off, like, and they, you know, they're the party of the rich, right? And so they're suddenly coming and having to kind of engage with like these people who are just completely different social status, and like you could see they just didn't know how to do it. They didn't know how to talk to these people, and it's like they're just people, dude, just kind of be sympathetic to them. They suffered really horribly, just be human, but they didn't know how to do it. And so that interaction between these completely different demographics and social demographics is just super interesting. And I think there's so much you can lean into in terms of like storytelling with that. And I think that's why a city is such a great place to kind of set these stories. Because as I said, you have these different, the strata of the society all in one place. You don't have to kind of go too far to find it. And it just makes it so much easier to write something that kind of links into all of these things, but is also pacey at the same time, and like manages to not get kind of bogged down. And, you know, because like in Game of Thrones, you have whole chapters where like someone is traveling somewhere, and it's like I love George R. Martin's writing. I think he's brilliant, but like there's some chapters where you're like, this is just a placeholder, and you can tell, and he's just having to come up with stuff that happens to kind of fill the time. And it's completely necessary, and I totally understand why he did it. He had to do it, but I don't feel it's not particularly effective storytelling, I guess. And I try to kind of avoid that, which is why the city setting kind of is so good, because it helps you avoid that, I guess. So
yeah, I agree. MJ agrees too. Let's
travel time. Yeah, I was gonna say, most of
all of our books take place in like singles.
Yeah, they all take place in a pretty small foot plan. But I want to, before we wrap up here, I want to return a little bit to the conversation of mood, the topic of mood, because you'd mentioned, I can't remember at this point whether it was in this take or part one of our talk, but you'd mentioned that you'd heard people arguing whether it was grimdark or not, which I think that ties back to setting, right? Because it is that kind of grittier, seedier setting. And especially, I think, for readers that may not have read a lot of grimdark, it may feel like it's a little darker because of the setting. I want to kind of explore a little bit how, including rogues, thieves, these characters that tend to lean on their wit, they're leaning on humor. Maybe they got a little swashbuckler energy to them, to bring back our chat with Sebastian. How do those elements kind of come together to adjust the mood, right? To kind of give some balance to the mood. And what's your advice for using those elements in tandem to create a grittier setting without going full grimdark?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really difficult because humor is such a hard thing to get right. It's also difficult because people like have different senses of humor, and like what someone will find funny is not necessarily what someone else. I seem to have quite an odd sense of humor, and a lot of things that loads of people find funny, I'm just not into at all. So I suppose the sense of humor in the book is my own one, and people seem to like it. So I don't know, but it is really difficult. I think it's really important because, as I said earlier, it's like such a. I think it's really something that makes us human is our sense of humor. It's such a massive part of being. Human being, and I think human beings are capable of finding humor in incredibly bleak moments. And like, I mean, even in like the First World War trenches, people were joking and like laughing about, like, which is insane to think about, but they were like. And it's humor as a coping mechanism, I think, a lot of in some kind of times. But it is really hard to get right, because obviously if you have too much of it, then the story you're telling just becomes a bit kind of like slapstick and a bit wacky, and you know, but if you don't have it,
it throws off the overall mood, right?
Yeah, it does. All of this is about, as MJ said, it's about a mood, and it's about trying to kind of like home in on that mood and kind of keep hold of it. And if you do too much or too little, it will just go one way or the other. And I think, yeah, that's obviously like a really difficult thing to do. I mean, I don't know, like this is, It's kind of hard because as I said before, I can't remember if I said it kind of during one of our chats or sort of before or after, but like, you know, so much of like writing Silverblood kind of, I just sort of did it over and over and over again until it kind of just, I felt like it worked. So it's really hard to kind of know, like, how did I balance the humor in it? I kind of don't know, because it's just like, you know, I just kind of did it and then rewrote it until I kind of felt it was like the right level. But I mean, I don't know. I'm trying to think, like, how would you go about something like that? I suppose the key thing, if I had to pick one thing and maybe say perhaps this is where it starts, is like, I think it has to feel genuine to the character. So I think Lucan is like, he's obviously got that kind of particular sense of humor. He's quite laconic. He's quite wry. He has that kind of just that wryness to him and that slightly dark sense of humor. It's very much part of his character. And so I think it doesn't feel unnatural that he would be in quite a difficult situation and would come out with like a humorous line. It kind of feels like the sort of thing he would do. I think even if he was kind of like on the front line of a battle and someone was like, this war horse was charging towards him with a lance, he'd probably still think something quite funny, like, because it's just kind of who he is. So I think the humor being genuine is the most important thing. I think the same is true of Flea as well. I think, you know, she has that certain kind of the banter that they have. I like to think, I mean, this is me kind of saying, oh yes, I wrote this really genuine humor, and you know, I'm assuming it works. I think it works, and like people seem to like it. So I'll, you know, but I hope that I think my main hope with that is that it feels genuine. And I think if you can get the humor to feel genuine, so it doesn't feel like it's forced. And I think this is a criticism I do see in people talking about books and what they liked and what they didn't like. And I think when it comes to humor, I think one of the main complaints that people make is that it just didn't feel like it belonged in that particular scene. So I suppose what I'm saying is you need to pick your moment. You need to pick the right moment. It needs to feel natural to the character, but it also needs to feel like natural to the scene as well. Like, and I think if one of those isn't quite in alignment, then it might just feel like it's a bit forced. I guess that's how I would kind of, but you know, one of the good things about writing rogues is because they're kind of, a lot of them are kind of like have that sharp witty banter, silver tongue type thing going on. I think it means that the chance for a joke is always there. So it's really just a case, you don't have to try and force it. I think it's kind of always there. You know, whereas if you were writing kind of a more dour kind of straight laced kind of character, it's a lot harder to lean into the humor on that. But with rogues, like the opportunity is always there. So I think it's just kind of about picking the right moment, I think. So I mean, that's how I would kind of position it. You know, I think it's just about It's about like taking advantage of their mercurial temperament and using the right moment to deploy that kind of that sort of sense of humor. But I do think it's important because I think like having someone to root for me is important, but also having the humor balance out all the bad stuff. I think that's why The Blade itself works so well. I think that's why Locke Gamora works so well. It's because you have the kind of quite hard hitting stuff. Also, the humor means that the hard hitting stuff hits harder because it's like, oh, this is quite fun and quite witty, and then boom, something really terrible happens, and it hits harder because of it.
A humorless situation is like a very good contrast to everything that's come before.
Yeah, and this also kind of ties into the low magic thing because, like, even though I kind of play like wizards and stuff when I'm role playing, like playing Baldur's Gate or whatever, I'll always be a mage character. But like the kind of the fiction I write tends to be quite low magic because I feel the reason for that is. Because when you do have a moment where the magic comes, it's that much more powerful, I think. Whereas when you've got a character that's just like flinging fireballs around, it's like, eh, whatever, it just becomes normal. But like when it's kind of sparse then and it's rare, then when it happens, not only is it surprising for the reader, but it's also surprising for the characters as well, because they maybe are not used to it. They're not used to seeing it. And certainly that happens in Silverblood. Like some of the magic in that, Lucan has never seen it before. And he's actually someone that has seen magic before. So it's not unfamiliar to him, but this kind of magic, he's never seen it, and that for him is kind of a mind-blowing moment, which means if the character is surprised by it, then the reader will be surprised by it, or should be surprised by it as well. So it's kind of, you know, it's using that same principle. It's about kind of trying to keep things in moderation and then picking the right moment to kind of deploy them. And that can apply to humor, it can apply to the magic, it can apply to any kind of sort of world-building element, I think. So I think that's quite a good rule to follow in general, I think, is what
read
I would
the room,
say
people read the scene.
Yeah. That's my rule. I'm going to stick to it. So
I like it.
I love it.
All right. Well, that's it for this mini masterclass and our two-parter with James. Thank you so much for thieving with us today, my friend.
Been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Thank you. As well, for anyone who contributes to our Patreon at $10 or more a month, you can hear a reading by James from The Silverblood Promise. It's out now in the UK. Go get yourself a copy, and it's out very soon in the US, May 7th. James, where can folks find you online?
Oh boy, yeah. So mostly Instagram, James Logan Author. Yeah, James Logan Author. And that's also my Blue Sky and Threads handle, though I don't appear on them as much. Also on Twitter as Spec Horizons. But yeah, like I said, mainly Instagram. And also my website, jamesloganauthor.com.
Fantastic. You can also follow SFF Addicts on all the socials at SFF Addicts Pod. You can follow me at Adrian M. Gibson. You can go pick up my book, Mushroom Blues, in paperback, hardcover, ebook if you want some mushroom goodness. MJ, what about you?
Yep, you can find me across all major social platforms at MJ Kuhn Books, all one word. Or you can just go to my website, mjkuhn.com, and all the links to everything are there. My socials, my newsletter, buy my books, all of it.
Support the TFF, the Thorn Food Fund.
Yes, the Thorn Food Fund.
Don't forget, people. All right. Well, yeah. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Now, keep reading, keep imagining, and we'll see you next time on SFF Addicts.